Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Marcellaro, and this week my guest is science communicator, Dr. Kiki Sanford. Kiki, good afternoon.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back again.
Yes, this is your fourth appearance on the show. You're one of my most popular guests. I think the most popular.
Woo-hoo.
So I enjoy
top of the
having
list
you.
For science.
Yes. Yeah. Yay for science. And every time I do the pre-show prep, I look at what you've been doing lately and what you've been talking about. And I go, oh, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that too. That's so cool. You really have this knack for digging into interesting and popular science subjects and bringing it home and making it interesting. So hats off to you in This Week in Science.
Thank you.
So I want to introduce you for the guests who may not have heard your previous shows. You are a neurophysiologist with a PhD from the University of California. Earlier in your career, you obtained a Bachelor of Science degree in conservation biology, a field that covers animals, their environment, and how humans impact them. And today you are a very popular science communicator and creator and host of This Week in Science, the podcast and radio show. And as I said, this is your fourth appearance here. And we always have so much fun. So
I always have fun. I'm glad you do too.
Well, you know me. Science geek. Meet science geek.
So oh, yeah.
For those who may not be familiar with This Week in Science, tell me a bit just quickly about the founding of This Week in Science, what you try to do, and your co-hosts.
Well, the founding of This Week in Science happened well over a decade ago, actually over 15 years ago, 18 years ago now. Oh, my goodness. It's so long ago while I was a grad student and hanging out, talking about science that we were reading in magazines and reading in journals. I was hanging out with my neighbors and drinking a few beers, and we just kept talking about science. And every day, a new scientific discovery, and we'd talk about it and talk about it. And one day, one of us said, we should be on the radio. And so we approached the local college radio station and we got a slot, and we're able to start talking about science on the radio. And that's where it really got started. And for me, I just fell in love with trying to tell the stories of science and trying to explain this complicated subject that's, you know, sometimes complicated, sometimes not so much, but to explain it to people and make it interesting and help people understand how science is a part of their lives every day and is a part of making their lives better. And so 18 years ago, I started with one co-host, Ted Dunning. And today I have two completely different co-hosts who are very different. And the show is a little bit different from when we started. Of course, we've evolved a bit over the years. But my co-hosts now are Justin Jackson, and he has been a salesman. He's not a scientist. He's lived his life as a salesman and is very proud of his carny background in barking, getting people at the carnival to come and play games and spend their money. And he's kind of been our everyman on the show. He comes up with crazy ideas sometimes, and a lot of listeners go, "What? Who are you? What is this crazy idea you're coming up with?" And I actually really love his perspective, because many times it's something that I haven't thought about, you know, that I didn't consider. Sometimes I'm like, oh my gosh, you're totally out in left field and you're really not on the right track here. But we can have that conversation about why it's not the right track. And so I think being able to have these conversations about how to think about science and what that there are different perspectives on how to interpret findings and their importance, that he does a really good job in that role. He's actually now moving into a career in science. And so his role in the show, I think, has inspired him to,
cool.
to get into a scientific career for himself. And our other co-host, Blair Bizdarich, is a zoologist. She works at the San Francisco Zoo, and her segment of the show is Blair's Animal Corner. She brings animal stories very often, or recently it's been a lot to do with conservation issues, because they are very important. But a lot of times it's a lot of fun animal behavior. Why do animals do the things that they do? And we get to talk about that.
Did you see the National Geographic episode about 2 weeks ago about Jane Goodall? It's called Jane.
Yes, there is a documentary. There's a documentary out. This documentary is amazing, and she is so deserving Her career has been dedicated to these animals and studying them. And also, she is one of the only female science communicators that I would say is on par with the big male names that you so easily remember. You know, it's Bill Nye. You know, he's an engineer, not actually a scientist, but he does science communications. Mm-hmm. Neil deGrasse Tyson, Carl Sagan, Michio Kaku, and then Jane Goodall. You know, she is one of the few amazing female science communicators out there. And I think she absolutely deserves to have her career and her life celebrated in this way.
It's a great 2-hour documentary. Her husband, yeah. her husband was a photographer who joined her to document what he was doing. And then all this color film got stuffed away somewhere, and it was found a few years ago.
So cool, yeah.
And we get to see her early exercises with the chimpanzees in color, and it's glorious. It's really worth show. It's a worthwhile show if you ever get a chance to see that. I don't know if it's on YouTube or where it is right now. I saw it when it was aired.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's very cool. So let's get into the meat of the show. I wanted to ask you about some topics that really interested me. Oh, by the way, how do you support This Week in Science? Do you have a Patreon account,
oh, we
right?
do. Yeah. This Week in Science, our website is twis.org. And we are listener supported. Every once in a while, we get offers for advertising, but I just never feel like it's the right fit to really do, you know, give up, you know, the complete autonomy. And so we are completely listener supported. We have a Patreon, and we also take donations on our website through PayPal.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. Okay. So I was looking at your recent shows, and everything you did interested me. So let's just kind of walk through some of them. Brains in brains. Researchers showed that mini human brains, I want to ask you about that, implanted into mouse brains survived and functioned and integrated into the host. Tell me about that. Is that as wide in scope as it sounds, or was it very limited? And how did that work? And what is a mini human brain?
Right. So these mini brains that they implanted into mouse brains, these are, it's a whole field of work now that has evolved over the last couple of years called organoids. And what organoids are they are multicellular, three-dimensional models of tissues. And so you can't grow a whole human brain in a dish, but you can grow these little mini brains. The problem is the reason that they won't grow to a full brain size is that they don't have the right instructions to allow blood vessels to grow into them as well, to bring nutrients into the inner cell masses. And so they reach a certain size, and then they're just limited by nutrient availability and being able to transport those nutrients up to the cells and into the cells at the center of the organoid. And so without vascularization, the mini brains only live a short period of time and are very limited in their applications for studying things like genetic diseases and disorders.
What can those brains do? Do they have optic nerves? Can they sense the surrounding?
No, nothing like that. I mean, the researchers would have to give very specific cellular instructions to get something like an optic nerve, but these are nerve cells from the brain. And, you know, you can have a particular population of nerve cells. So say they are sampled from one area of the brain or the other or another, they would have more specific characteristics, you know, specific to those particular areas of the brain. But where these organoids usually start is from a very basic starting point. And so they're just a mass of neurons that are connecting to each other and responding to each other.
What happens to the mouse after the implant? Does the mouse gain new capabilities, or was it sufficient to have it just survive?
So this was the interesting question on a number of levels. So they didn't just add the human brain mass, this little mass of cells, this mini brain. They didn't just stick it on top of the mouse brain. They actually removed a small area of the mouse's brain and replaced that with human cells. So they were like, okay, we've got the human cells that have only grown to this point, but they're all connected to each other. Then we've got the mouse. We're going to cut out this part of the brain and we're going to, like a puzzle piece, we're going to just stick the human cells in there. And then are the human cells going to connect to the mouse brain?
Yeah.
Is the mouse brain going to connect to the human cells? Are blood vessels going to grow from the mouse brain into this mass of human cells? And the answer on all these accounts is yes.
Wow. So, and most importantly, does the mouse have a desire to watch Netflix?
Yeah, no. So the fear of like humanizing a mouse, that did not happen at all. So there were normal action potentials and integration. The cells were talking to each other. The human cells were talking to the mouse cells and the mouse cells were talking to the human cells. And they did behavioral tests and the mice didn't gain any new abilities. They didn't get any smarter. Their memories didn't get any better, but they were able to behave at the same level as control mice who didn't have any implant at all. So what this means is that the human brain cells didn't take away from the mouse abilities at all. The mouse is living like a normal mouse. What this means is now researchers can potentially get these organoids to last for a longer period of time, you know, months and months instead of just days to weeks, to be able to study the effects of diseases. So say you've got, you know, you're looking at a genetic disorder or a model of Alzheimer's disease. You can take cell samples, skin samples from people with diseases, turn those skin samples into brain cells in a dish, turn them into this organoid, and they've got whatever genetic problem it is. You take that, stick it into the mouse brain, and then you can see whether or not the cell, what happens to the mouse. You can see how those human cells behave. You can see how they integrate. You can see if there are similar problems developing in the mice to what we see as that develop in humans.
Fascinating. And, you know, it's spinning through my brain right now for the sci-fi and sci-fi fans out there. Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now that's the science part of it. Let me ask you a grander question on a personal opinion basis. Do you think that this has potential for perhaps someday doing the Star Trek science fiction thing where you can transplant a healthy brain into a new body in some way? I mean, it's a big stretch, but I mean, this seems like the beginning of a road. For that.
I think it is a huge stretch, but researchers have been working on trying to be able to replace damaged brain tissue for some time. I mean, could you imagine if we could replace the damaged brain tissue of stroke victims?
Oh, yeah.
What if we could replace the damaged tissue of people with multiple sclerosis? And if we could replace it and
those it integrates and heals and functions.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you would end up with people regaining function. And so the possibilities, the whole brain transplant, brain to body transplant, you know, that is another level up. It's science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And there are so many complications, you know, just in getting the brain to communicate with another body and all the connectivity. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on.
But you got to start somewhere.
So,
just like we started with quantum computers, you know, it was very, very primitive, you know, making slow progress.
Somewhere.
Yeah, start somewhere.
Slow and steady progress. That's what science is about.
Cool. All right. Yeah. So let's move on. So that was cool.
I know. That's what I love. I just got that story made me so excited when it came out.
Fun.
I was like, this is amazing.
The next topic I want to ask you about is right up your alley, and that's bird vision. And you talked about magnetoreception in birds make it possible thanks to proteins in their eyes. My head is swimming now because you've been on the show and we've talked about this before. So tell me about what magnetoreception is in bird eyes.
Well, birds who migrate, and maybe birds that don't migrate and just kind of hang out too, maybe they have this ability, but we see it in birds that can migrate. They are able to orient themselves according to the magnetic fields of the earth. And in laboratory simulations and situations, researchers are able to stick birds in cages and apply large magnetic fields and change their orientations.
But I thought it was magnetic material in the brain of the bird, not the eye.
So exactly. And so it's gone through all sorts of ideas. At first, people thought that there were magnetic particles in the brain that were orienting within nerve cells. Mm-hmm. And that's what was leading to this ability to orient, that, okay, these magnetic particles are lining up, polarizing with the magnetic field. And that's why the birds know which way to go. No. And then they thought, okay, it's magnetic particles in the beaks of the birds, because they found iron particles in the beaks of birds.
Is this related to the bird's diet?
No, it's not related to the bird's diet. And so this is what that was the next thought, and that didn't work out either.
I thought maybe they
were
eating something that contained iron ferrous material or something like that.
Yeah, nope, has nothing to do with the diet.
Oh, and cool. Then,
and so what it
is,
what researchers have discovered most recently is that it's related to proteins in the eye. And there are particular proteins, cryptochromes, within the eye that are related to timekeeping. And so these cryptochromes are...
Oh, no, you got to define that term for me now.
They are related to... they get activated when they're stimulated by light. And sometimes these cryptochromes are also involved in eye coloration. And
are we talking about amino acids?
Pigment cells? No, they are not amino acids. Okay. I mean,
I'm just along with the listeners. I'm just trying to wade my way through this. Sorry.
No worries. Let me think about. So these cryptochromes are actually, when they're stimulated by light. So you know how there's the idea of the circadian clock, and how if you're when you're traveling, mm-hmm. you want to expose yourself to light early in the morning,
right,
to be able to kind of get your clock set, your brain to know when you're supposed to be awake and when you're supposed to sleep. Well, every species from yeast to us all across the board have these cryptochromes, which respond to light and are involved in setting the circadian rhythms, the day and night sleep-wake cycle of animals. And
do we understand the timekeeping mechanism that's going on there? Is it a chemical reaction that paces itself?
Yeah, there are chemical reactions. It's very complicated. There are, I mean, that's a different mechanism from this magnetoreception. But technically what happens is you have these receptors, these cryptochromes within the eye, and these proteins receive the light, they get stimulated, and they stimulate neurons in the optic nerve. And some of these neurons actually go back to stimulate the hypothalamus in the middle of the brain. And then there are certain areas of the hypothalamus and certain sets of neurons that get into a feedback loop that drive this rhythm. And so light sets it and triggers it, but there are these neuron systems that actually drive this ongoing circuit. Now, for magnetoreception itself, these cryptochromes that they were looking at that respond to light and were involved in the circadian rhythm, some of them didn't seem to be involved. There were four of them they were looking at, and they realized that there were a couple that were not so involved in the circadian rhythm. They were just doing their own thing. And so when they investigated this particular, these cryptochromes.
Like cryptochromes.
Kind of. Yeah, they're there. They're like the other ones, but they're one of these things is doing its own thing, right? They realized that the cryptochromes were actually responding and were stimulated by magnetic fields.
Wow.
Yes. And what they think, and if you've ever worn polarized glasses.
All the time. Yeah.
And so the polarized lenses in sunglasses, sometimes you can see like a shading of the light where it's like almost like stripes, you know, if the polarization wears off in one area and not in another, you can see that polarization. And so they think that the magnetic fields are actually visible to the birds as kind of a darkening and a lightening of the visual field.
heads-up display for the bird.
Yeah, it's a HUD. Exactly. But it's all done in their eyes by the stimulation of these cryptochromes.
Wow. Yeah. Who knew?
Who knew? And it's just amazing because we've gone from through all these. I've been following this for years. And, you know, the various hypotheses about what could be involved in this magnetoreception, allowing it to happen. You know, it's like, it's gotta be an iron particle. Yeah. It's gotta be this, it's gotta be that. And it's not, it's a completely different.
Fascinating. Does it make you wish you were back in the lab?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
I love the investigation of these problems. Yeah. I mean, more so I want to go to the lab where the researchers have been doing the work, talk to the researchers and go visit their birds. That's what I'd want. And then I can tell the story even better to people. So that's kind of where I am now in my career.
All right. Well, it's time to take a break. It's already that time, folks. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. I'm chatting with science communicator Dr. Kiki Sanford. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
We're back. I'm chatting with the host and founder of This Week in Science, Dr. Kiki Sanford. All right, so I'm going to get on to one of your other favorite subjects now, world robot domination.
We heard on Monday
something that I had predicted just last week in light of Amazon's work with another product, the Fire TV Edition, and I suggested that Amazon was probably working on a family service companion robot. That was on Wednesday of last week. And then Monday, Jeff Gamet publishes an article about a secret Amazon project described by Mark Gurman at Bloomberg Technology about Vesta. Some sort of family companion robot that's apparently going to ship in 2019. Is this the beginning of the end? Have you read about this? And what do you think about it all?
I don't think it's the beginning of the end. I mean, it's the beginning of our more integrated relationship with robots, mm-hmm. for sure. I mean, we have already accepted, like we've talked about on previous shows, we've accepted these smartphone devices and you know, the Apple iPad changed a lot for how people use these smart devices in their lives. And so I think this is just the next iteration.
The description we have so far is that this robot could possibly be used for home sentry security work. And in addition, it would wander around, be mobile, it would be delivering sound and music to you wherever you are. It could actually, you know, walk into the bathroom and say, "Hey, you're low on toilet paper. Shall I order you some more? It'll be on your desk on your front porch
Vesta,
tomorrow."
Hey, Vesta, get out of here. I want some privacy.
Yeah, so, you know, and Amazon is working hard to have deliveries, you know, inside your front door with sentries or in the trunk of your car if it's parked in the driveway. And now Amazon is trying to have a sort of like device that wanders around your home and can be very helpful in an Alexa kind of way. But, you know, it also feels kind of creepy. Are we in for another stage here of awakening or evolution about what we are allowing to happen in our house with robots?
Yeah, I mean, that it's the big question these days, right? How much convenience will we put up with, or how much convenience do we want to balance out the invasion of our privacy, right?
Right.
How much, you know, where is that fine line I mean, we already are willing to give up so much personal information to make things a little bit easier, right? So that I can connect to people online, so that I can.
Are you trying to say Facebook without saying Facebook?
Maybe.
I'll say it for you, Facebook.
Yeah, and but Facebook is the big bad wolf these days. You know, Cambridge Analytics and everything that has been involved there, but they're not the only one. They're just the one that has been caught, and everybody's talking about. You know, it's. The way that Facebook has tried to integrate itself as, you know, your best friend, the yearbook that allows you to keep up with your friends and your family. I mean, they're really trying to be within your private life. And so it's a little bit different from platforms like Twitter, where it's just people, you know, spewing out whatever it is they need to at any given moment.
Listeners know that I don't chat up a lot on Twitter, because if I talk about my favorite movies or my favorite foods, it's idle chat. Nobody really cares. But Twitter cares, because that's valuable information about my tastes and preferences. Yeah, so for my absolutely. Listeners, that's why I'm not real chatty on Twitter. I point to stuff that I write about. But other than that, I try not to just blurt out stuff. Some people do.
I think a lot of people would be helped a bit if people didn't blurt things out so much.
Yeah. I agree.
No, I mean the personal robot. I recently interviewed Ayanna Howard, who is a roboticist and is at Georgia Tech University, and she's working on this kind of studying this integration of artificial intelligence and robotics into our lives. You know, asking that question, how can we make better robots to help people live better lives, as opposed to building robots that will, you know, invade our lives?
That's the big question. So how do we maneuver our social structure in such a way that the robots become helpful instead of big tech giant insidious? Is it regulation? Is there some sensible legislation that can be passed that says, you know, we're not trying to stop innovation, we're not trying to put shackles on these tech giants, but are there minimum principles, you know, not like as something along the lines of Asimov's three laws of robotics, but something simpler, more basic. Here's how we want our new technology robots to interact with humans. Here's the groundwork. Here's the rules and regulations in a simple way for health, mm-hmm. safety, privacy, security, sensible regulation. Is there something we can do in that area? Do you think that's called for?
I think it's absolutely called for. And I think this is the kind of conversation that everybody should be having about the devices they use and bring into their homes. And we should be talking about what we want from the companies that are creating these technologies. You know, we are the consumers. We are not just, you know, these things are not being forced into our homes and our lives. We are choosing to accept them. And so in that, it's our responsibility to choose things that, you know, we feel good about as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
As opposed to a Steve Jobs, one more thing kind of surprise. You didn't know what you wanted until we thought of it. Now we're going to tell you what you need. So just go out and buy it, because we're Apple.
I know. Go buy it. Go get it.
Yeah,
no.
Well, that's something I talked about on a news show the other day with Jeff Gammon, and that is that Apple has a chance to leverage its reputation on privacy and security here and get out ahead of the game. And so the announcement about Amazon Vesta got us talking on the TMO's Daily Observations podcast about, you know, whether Apple needs to sit back and wait and watch this evolve, or whether they need to get out ahead of the game and convince consumers that Apple is the company that knows how to make, as we said, friendly, secure, safe, mindful, mm-hmm. proper
mindful.
Mm-hmm. Robots that serve us instead of undermine us. So that was the discussion, and I'll keep writing about that until Apple does something sensible.
I know. Fingers crossed. I mean, I'd love to see Apple do something really great in this space and, you know, kind of push things forward in a positive way, as opposed to trailing behind and hoping they can catch up later.
Well, you know, they're one of the big four giants. We got Cortana, we got Google Home, we got Alexa, and we got Siri. And so Apple has a stake in this AI game. So you would think that that stake in their AI development would extend to, you know, the next generation of family companion robots. So,
yeah,
we hope Apple does it.
We hope. Right now, I just keep seeing the big Google is going after Amazon. And that's like the big thing people are talking about, you know, how much money Google's putting into it as a to try and catch up and compete with Amazon. And so I have, you know, the conversation about what Apple's doing. It's like they are one of the big four, but get into the game.
Please.
Please.
So speaking of Apple, one of the things that we've been discussing here at the Mac Observer for a long time now is the Apple Watch and non-invasive blood glucose monitoring.
Yeah.
And I've been watching that for a long time. And just the other day, Tim Cook said that he wanted to develop that, but he didn't want to have to go through the FDA process, which could be lengthy and reveal Apple's product plans and whatever. So tell me, you discussed this on the show, bloodless monitoring, a non-invasive patch is being developed. Is this the next stage or is this something that's been being worked on all along?
Well, I think this is something, you know, this is something that people have been aiming for. This is a goal for quite a while. Every time diabetics have to test their blood, you know, they have to stick themselves with a sharp needle in order to take that blood. I mean, that's uncomfortable. It's not fun. Is there a better way to do it? And researchers have really been trying to figure this out. And some researchers from the University of Bath in the UK have developed a non-invasive patch, and there's no pricking at all. And
is this the perspiration technique where you can assess
it's perspiration and based on the water diffusion, and it sucks the water through your skin cells and the glucose, there's glucose in there, a certain amount in there that they have been able to correlate to how much glucose is in blood. And so, because there is a correlation between how much glucose is in this perspiration and blood, it's able to give a very accurate measurement.
That calibration has been an issue, right? Making sure that you have the accurate correspondence between the perspiration.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So how does it do a readout? Does it have like an LCD display built into the patch, or how do you know?
No. Yeah. So this so far is just a patch, and I think it changes color at this point in time. But other researchers are working on a tattoo of sorts. And so these usually at this point, they're not connected to other devices. But what could happen, especially with this patch, is that you have it stuck to your skin, kind of like a Band-Aid. And then it is connected either wirelessly through Bluetooth or connected directly to a smart device. Maybe it is, you know, in the band of your watch, even.
Thermoelectric, maybe. Use the heat of your skin to generate a little electricity and then pop out a signal.
Exactly. And so the great thing, this adhesive patch doesn't need a lot of electricity, and then you can get a signal. And so the integration of this with the technology like the Apple Watch and other monitor, other devices that could be used as monitors is so close. And so I'm just waiting for Apple to jump on this and be like, okay, how can we help? Let's make this happen.
Right. The trick is to integrate that technology from a patch, maybe over to the wristband of your watch.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's what I think what Apple's working on. That would be cool.
Yep.
Can't wait for that.
Oh, it's going to be amazing. Life simpler.
Starting to run out of time here.
No.
I'm not going to get anywhere near through this list, but hopefully I'll hit the hot buttons here. Bathroom bacteria. You had a segment on one of your shows where you talked about how it's better to use a paper towel than an air dryer. Tell me about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So the study recently, I mean, we worry about paper towels and cutting down trees and, you know, hair, the electric dryers, the air dryers in bathrooms that use electricity to power fans that blow off your hands. And so if you're just like, I don't know which one's better, paper towels are actually going to be better for decreasing the spread of bacteria.
How is that happening?
Well, a number of different ways. the hot air blows the water from your hands and also aerosolizes particles from your hand. And so bacteria become airborne and can spread. So if you didn't
presuming
wash
your hand
your
is
hand,
clean at that point,
so
right?
Maybe you don't wash your hands very well. Yeah.
Oh, that's all right. So now, so now we need a timer on the mirror that says, nope, you're not done yet. Keep washing.
Exactly. The other is that we know that bacteria does spread a bit from flushing of toilets, that there's aerosolized stuff that gets into the air. And fans increase airflow in the rooms and the dispersion of bacteria. And then additionally, bacteria grow inside the fans themselves. And so that's where it comes down to bacteria inside these fans getting blown onto your hands directly.
Now, the social problem here is that restaurants and other facilities think that they're going to save money by not having paper towels. McDonald's is notable for this, I think. And there is the social meme of being green and not having waste baskets full of paper towels. So you save money, you look green. How do you turn that around in the social culture to respect the real science of what's going on?
I think we make it okay for people to have wet handprints on their shirts.
Your date will be amused.
Well, you know, I didn't want to kill any trees or be responsible for the death of trees by using the paper towels. And I didn't want to spread any bacteria with that hot air dryer, which is also using coal-powered energy. So, you know, I just used my shirt. There we go.
All right. Well,
yeah. All these choices in life, you know, maybe air dry.
I think that's a good place to end. We've run out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we've done it again. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this. It was great. I've learned a lot. Every time I talk to Dr. Kiki, I have a lot of fun and I learn a lot.
There's so many things.
I just explain it so well, too. Yeah.
There are so many things in this world, and it's so exciting and interesting to make our world just a richer place. And so if I helped out anyone understand anything today a little bit better, I'm really glad, and thanks for everyone for listening.
Tell us where we can find This Week in Science. Tell us how we can support you financially, and tell us how people can contact you personally.
All right. So if you are interested in more of this great sciencey stuff, you can find us This Week in Science just about anywhere podcasts are found, iTunes or the Apple Podcast Marketplace, Google Play Podcasts, Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn, Facebook, YouTube. We are there. You can also go directly to twis.org. Twis.org is my website. And there you'll find links to Patreon, our crowdfunding community, and also to donate directly through PayPal. And if you would like to contact me, easiest way is to find me on Twitter. I'm Dr. Kiki, D-R-K-I-K-I.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you again for being on the show and coming back over and over and amazing us all and delighting us. So thanks for being our guest.
Thank you so much for inviting me back again, John.
It was great. Folks, I hope you enjoyed the show and you've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you again next week.